Like this? Julie asked, drawing a low-cut shape in the air. Florence hesitated. Yes. No. Yes, that one. And the new little hat with the cornflowers. Oh, Julie, I really never thought I would get to wear that little hat. Well, you're right. I mustn't think about it any more. I'd go mad. I wonder if they have any more of that ochre powder. The last one. We'll have to find out. Madame would be wise to buy several boxes. It came from England. Oh, you don't have to tell me. You know, Julie, we don't really understand what is going on. These events will have an unimaginable impact, believe me. Unimaginable. People's lives will be changed for generations. We'll be hungry this winter. Just get out my grey leather handbag with a gold clasp, that's all. I wonder what Paris is like, said Florence, walking into the bathroom. But the noise of the running water Julie had just turned on drowned out her words. Meanwhile, less frivolous thoughts were passing through Cot's mind. He too was lying in the bath. At first he had been filled with such joy, such profound natural peace, that he was reminded of the delights of childhood, his happiness when eating an iced meringue full of cream, dipping his feet in a cool stream, pressing a new toy to his heart. He felt no desire, no regret, no anguish. His head was clear and calm. His body floated in a warm liquid element that caressed him, gently tickled his skin, washed away the dust, the sweat, insinuated itself between his toes and slid beneath his back like a mother lifting her sleeping child. The bathroom smelled of tar soap, hair lotion, eau de cologne, lavender water. He smiled, stretched out his arms, cracked the knuckles on his long, pale fingers, savoured the divine, simple pleasure of being safe from the bombs and taking a cool bath on a very hot day. He couldn't pinpoint the exact moment when bitterness cut through him like a sharp knife through a piece of fruit. Perhaps it was when he happened to glance at the suitcase full of manuscripts on the chair, or when the soap fell into the water and he had to fish it out, the strain to his muscles disrupting his state of euphoria. Whenever it was, at a certain point he frowned, and his face, which had been clearer, smoother than usual, almost rejuvenated, became sombre and anxious once again. What would become of him? What would become of Gabriel Cot? What was happening to the world? What would be the general mood in future? Either people would think only about being able to survive and there would be no place for art, or they would become obsessed by a new ideal, as after every crisis before. A new ideal? A new fashion, more like, he thought with cynicism and weariness. But he, Cot, was too old to adapt to new tastes. He'd already changed his style in 1920. A third time would be impossible. It exhausted him just to think about what was to come. What kind of world was about to be born? Who could predict the shape it would take as it emerged from the harsh matrix of this war, as from a bronze mould? It would be magnificent, or misshapen, or both, this universe now showing its first signs of life. It was terrible to look at himself, to see himself, and to understand nothing, for he understood nothing. He thought of his book, his manuscript sitting on a chair, rescued from the fire, from the bombs. He felt intensely despondent. The passions he described, his feelings, his scruples, this history of a generation, his generation, they were all old, useless, obsolete. Obsolete, he repeated in despair. And a second time, the soap, slippery as a fish, disappeared into the water. He swore, sat up, angrily rang the bell. His servant came in. Rub me down, Gabriel Cot sighed, his voice shaking. Once his legs had been massaged with the glove and the eau de cologne applied, Cot felt better. Standing naked in the bathroom, he began to shave, while the servant laid out his clothes, a linen shirt, a lightweight tweed suit, a blue tie. Are there any people we know? Asked Cot.
I don't know, monsieur. I haven't seen many people, though I've been told a lot of cars arrived last night and then left straight away for Spain. Monsieur Jules Blanc was here. He went to Portugal.
Jules Blanc?
Cot paused, his soapy razor poised in mid-air. Jules Blanc? Gone to Portugal on the run? This piece of news was a bad blow. Like everyone who makes sure they get the most comfort and pleasure from life, Gabriel Cot had a politician in his pocket. In exchange for excellent dinners, wonderful parties, Florence's little attentions, in exchange for a few well-placed and timely newspaper articles, he had had from Jules Blanc, member with portfolio in nearly every cabinet, twice Prime Minister, four times Minister of War, thousands of the small favours that make life easier. It was thanks to Jules Blanc that he had been commissioned to present his Great Lovers series on the radio last winter. It was Jules Blanc who had given him responsibility for the patriotic addresses and moral exhortations broadcast on the radio, and it was Jules Blanc who had insisted that the head of an important daily newspaper pay 130,000 francs instead of the 80,000 previously agreed for Cot's novel. Finally, he had promised that Cot would be made a commander of the Legion of Honour. Jules Blanc was a small but necessary cog in the machinery of his career, for genius cannot simply float in the clouds, it must also operate down on earth. On learning of his friend's fall, Blanc must have been involved in some pretty dishonest business to have taken this desperate measure, since it was he who always liked to say that in politics defeat prepares you for victory, Cot felt alone and abandoned at the edge of an abyss. Once again, he was struck with dreadful force by the existence of a new world, unknown to him, a world where everyone will become miraculously chaste, selfless, and full of noble ideals. Already, that tendency to imitate, which is an integral part of the survival instinct for plants, animals, and people, made him declare, "Ah, so he's left. The day of these hedonists, these political wheeler-dealers, is over." After a moment's silence, he added, "Poor France." Slowly he put on his blue socks. Naked, except for his black silk suspenders and socks, his skin a shiny white with yellowish tinges, he did some arm and chest exercises, then looked at himself approvingly in the mirror. "Now that is definitely better," he said, as if he expected the words to make his servant very happy. Then he finished dressing. He went down to the bar just after noon. There was a certain panic going on in the lobby, and it was clear that distant disasters were sending tremors through the rest of the universe. People had left their luggage piled untidily on the stage that was normally used as a dance floor. Shouting was coming from the kitchens. Pale, dishevelled women were wandering around the corridors looking for a room. The lifts weren't working, and an old man was crying, standing in front of a porter who refused to give him a bed. "You must understand, monsieur, it's not that I don't want to, but it's impossible, simply impossible. We're full to bursting, monsieur." "Just a tiny little corner room, that's all," begged the poor man. "I told my wife I would meet her here. We got separated in the bombing in Etampes. She'll think I'm dead. I'm 70 years old, monsieur, and she's 68. We've never been apart before." He took out his wallet, hands trembling. "I'll give you 1,000 francs. And on this ordinary Frenchman's honest, modest face, you could see his shame at having to offer a bribe for the first time in his life, and his fear at having to spend all his money. But the porter refused to take it. "I'm telling you, monsieur, it's impossible. Try in town." "In town? But I've just come from there. I've been knocking at doors since 5 o'clock this morning. They treat me like a dog. I'm not just anyone. I'm a physics teacher at the Saint-Omer Sixth Form College. I've been decorated for services to education." But he finally realized the porter had stopped listening a long time ago and had turned his back on him. Picking up a little hat box he'd dropped on the ground, which clearly contained all his belongings, he left without saying a word. The porter was now fighting off four Spanish women with black hair and heavy makeup. One of them was clutching his arm.
Once in a lifetime, all right, it happens, but twice is too much, she exclaimed in bad French, her voice hoarse and loud. To have lived through the war in Spain, escaped to France, and then end up in this mess is too much. But, madame, there's really nothing I can do. You can give me a room. That's impossible, madame, impossible. The Spaniard tried to think of some scathing reply, an insult, but her mind was blank. For a moment she was choked with anger. Then she exclaimed, Well, you're not what I call a man. Me, shouted the porter, suddenly losing all his professional passivity and jumping up and down in outrage. Oh, what about you? Have you quite finished insulting me? Just remember, you're a foreigner, so shut up or I'll call the police. Regaining a little of his dignity, he held open the door and pushed out the four women who were still shouting insults in Castilian. Oh, what hard days, monsieur, and nights, he said to Corte. The world has gone mad, monsieur. Corte walked into a long, cool room. It was silent and dark, and the bar was quiet. All the commotion stopped at this doorway. The closed shutters on the large windows protected him from the heat of the raging sun. The aroma of quality leather, excellent cigars and vintage brandy hung in the air. The Italian barman, an old friend of Cott's, welcomed him impeccably, expressing his joy at seeing him again and his sympathy at France's misfortunes. He did this with such dignity and tact, mindful of his inferior status with regard to Corte, and aware that the terrible events demanded respect, that Corte felt immediately comforted. "I'm pleased to see you as well, my good man," he said gratefully. "Did Monsieur have difficulty leaving Paris?" "Ah," was all Corte said. He raised his eyes to heaven. Joseph, the barman, made a discreet little gesture with his hand, as if to prevent Corte from confiding in him, refusing to be the one to bring back such fresh, painful memories. And in the same way a doctor might say to a patient who is having a fit, "Drink this first, then you can tell me all about it," he murmured, "Shall I fix you a martini?" With a chilled glass and two small dishes of olives and crisps in front of him, Corte took in the familiar surroundings with the weak smile of a convalescent. He then looked at the men who had just joined him in the room. Well, well, they were all there, the academic and the former minister, the important industrialist, the editor, the head of a newspaper, the MP, the playwright, and the writer who, under the pseudonym General X, wrote articles for an important Parisian magazine, in which he summarized military events for the masses in great technical detail and with the utmost optimism, while always managing to remain vague. The next military theatre of operations will be in Northern Europe, or the Balkans, or the Ruhr, or all three simultaneously, or else at some point on the globe impossible to predict. Yes. They were all here, and in perfect health. For a brief moment, Corte was stunned. He couldn't have said why, but for the past 24 hours he had thought the old world was crumbling, and he was the only man left amid the rubble. It was an inexpressible relief to see once again all his famous friends, even his enemies. Today, any disagreements seemed unimportant. They were all on the same side. They were all together. They were living proof that nothing was changing. Contrary to belief, they weren't witnessing some extraordinary cataclysm, the end of the world, but rather a series of purely human events, limited in time and space, which, all in all, affected only the lives of people they didn't know. Their conversation was pessimistic, almost despairing, but their voices light-hearted. Some of them had done very well for themselves. They were at that age when one looks at young people and thinks, let them make their own way. Others were compiling a hasty mental inventory of all the pages they'd written, all the speeches they'd given, which might help them win favour with the new government. And since they had all more or less lamented the fact that France had lost her greatness, lost her daring, and was no longer producing children, none of them was very worried. The politicians were rather more anxious, for some of them were in a difficult position and were pondering a change of alliance. The playwright and Corte discussed their own work, without a thought for the rest of the world.
Chapter 28. The Michauds never made it to Tours. A bomb destroyed the railway line, the train stopped, and the refugees found themselves once more on the road, mingling with the German troops. They were ordered to go back the way they had come. The Michauds found Paris half empty. They'd been away for 2 weeks and expected to find it different, as one does after a long trip. Instead, they walked home through the untouched streets and couldn't believe their eyes. Everything was in its place. The blazing sun shone down on the houses, all with their shutters closed, exactly as on the day they had left. A sudden heat wave had shriveled all the leaves on the plane trees, but no one had swept them up, and the refugees waded through them with weary legs. There didn't seem to be a food shop open. Now and again this barren landscape threw up a surprise. It looked like a city wiped out by the plague, but just as you were about to scream, "Everybody's either dead or gone," you'd find yourself face to face with a nicely dressed lady wearing makeup, or, in the Michaud's case, a woman getting a perm at a hairdresser's, nestled between a boarded-up butcher shop and a bakery. It was Madame Michaud's hairdresser. She called to him. He, his assistant, his wife, and the client all ran to the door and exclaimed, "Were you on the roads?" Madame Michaud pointed to her bare legs, her torn dress, her face covered with sweat and dust. "As you can see, what's happened to our apartment?"
"Well, everything is fine. I was walking past your windows just today," said the hairdresser's wife. "Nothing's been touched." "What about my son, Jean-Marie? Has anyone seen him?"
"How could you expect anyone to have seen him, my poor darling?" said Maurice, who had joined her. "You're not being logical."
"And what about you, always so calm?" "He'll be the death of me," she replied angrily. "Maybe the concierge."
And she turned to go.
"Don't get upset, Madame Michaud. There's nothing for you. I asked as I was passing. There's no post any more."
Jeanne tried to hide her cruel disappointment with a smile.
"All right. All we can do is wait," she said,
but her lips were trembling. She sat down without thinking and murmured, "What should we do now?"
"If I were you," said the hairdresser, a fat little man with a round, sweet face, "I'd start by having your hair washed. It will clear your mind. We could also freshen Monsieur Michaud up a bit. And while I'm doing that, my wife can make you something to eat."
So it was agreed. He was massaging Jeanne's head with lavender oil when his son ran in to announce that the armistice had been signed. She was too exhausted and downcast to take in the importance of the news, just as a person who has shed so many tears at the bedside of someone who is dying has none left for the actual moment of death. But Maurice, remembering 1914, the battles, his wounds, his suffering, felt a wave of bitterness wash over his heart. But there was nothing more to say, so he remained silent. They were in Madame Josse's salon for more than an hour, then left to go home. People were saying that there were relatively few casualties among French soldiers, but that the prisoners numbered nearly 2 million. Could Jean-Marie perhaps be a prisoner? They daren't hope for anything more. They reached their house. Despite all Madame Josse's assurances, they couldn't really believe that it was still standing and not reduced to ashes, like the burning buildings they'd walked past last week in the Place du Martois in Orléans. But they could see the door, the concierge's lodge, the letterbox, empty, the key waiting for them, and the concierge herself. The risen Lazarus must have experienced the same feeling of astonishment and quiet pride on seeing his sisters and the soup cooking on the fire. "In spite of everything, we've come back. We're home," they thought. "But what's the point if my son..." was Jeanne's second thought. She looked at Maurice, who smiled weakly at her, then said out loud to the concierge, "Hello, Madame Nonin." The concierge was elderly and half-deaf. The Michauds cut short their stories of the exodus as much as possible. Madame Nonin had gone as far as the Porte d'Italie with her daughter, who was a laundress. She had then had an argument with her son-in-law and come back home.
"They have no idea what's happened to me. They probably think I'm dead," she said with some satisfaction. They probably think they're going to get hold of my savings now. Not that she's a bad sort, she added, referring to her daughter. She's just canny.
The Michauds said they were tired and went up to their apartment. The lift was broken.
Well, that's the last straw,
Jeanne moaned, laughing in spite of herself. While her husband slowly climbed the stairs, she rushed on ahead, recovering the speed and stamina she'd had as a young girl. My God, to think she'd sometimes curse this dark staircase, their basic apartment with no cupboards, no bathroom. They'd had to get a bathtub put in the kitchen, and radiators that regularly broke down in dead of winter. The cosy world in which she had lived for 15 years, and whose walls contained such sweet, such warm memories, had been returned to her. Peering over the banister, she saw Maurice much further down. She was alone. She leaned forward to kiss the door, then got out her key and opened it. It was her apartment, her refuge. Here was Jean-Marie's room, the kitchen, the sitting room, and the sofa on which, in the evening after getting home from the bank, she would stretch out her tired legs. Remembering the bank suddenly made her shudder. She hadn't thought about it in a week. When Maurice came in, he saw she was worried and that her joy at being home had vanished. "What's the matter?" he asked. "Is it Jean-Marie?"
"No, the bank."
"My God, we did everything humanly possible and more to get to Tours. They couldn't possibly hold it against us."
"They won't hold it against us," she said, "if they want to keep us. But I've only worked there on an interim basis since the war. And as for you, my poor darling, you've never been able to get along with them. So if they want to get rid of us, now's the time."
The thought had crossed my mind.
As always, when he agreed wholeheartedly and didn't argue with her, she suddenly changed her mind.
"Nevertheless, they'd have to be the worst bastards."
"They are the worst bastards," Maurice said gently. "You know that, don't you? We've had our share of worries. We're together. We're at home. Let's not think about anything else."
They didn't mention Jean-Marie. They couldn't even say his name without crying, and they didn't want to cry. They'd always had a burning desire to be happy. Perhaps because they loved each other so much, they had learned to live one day at a time, deliberately not thinking about tomorrow. They weren't hungry. They opened a jar of jam, a box of biscuits, and with infinite care, Jeanne made them some coffee. There was only a quarter of a pound left of the pure mocha coffee they usually saved for special occasions.
"But what more special occasion could there be?" said Maurice.
"None like this, I hope," his wife replied. "Still, we can't pretend we'll be able to replace it easily if the war drags on."
"You make it seem almost sinful," said Maurice, breathing in the wonderful aroma wafting up from the coffee pot.
After their light meal, they sat down by the open window. They both had a book open on their laps, but they weren't reading. They finally fell asleep, side by side, holding hands. They spent several days rather peacefully. Since there was no post, they knew they couldn't get any news, good or bad. All they could do was wait. At the beginning of July, Monsieur de Fourrière returned to Paris. It was said, after the armistice of 1919, that the Count de Fourrière had had a good war. He had faced danger heroically for a few months, then married a very rich young woman while on leave. After that, he cared a little less for the idea of getting himself killed, which was understandable. Nevertheless, he refused to take advantage of his wife's excellent connections. If he no longer sought out danger, he didn't run away from it either. He finished the war without once being wounded, pleased with himself for his commendable behaviour in battle, his inner confidence, and his military decoration. In 1939 he held an excellent place in society. His wife was a Salomon Worms. His sister had married the Marquis de Maigle. He was a member of the Jockey Club. His receptions and hunting parties were famous. He had two charming daughters, the eldest of whom had recently become engaged. He had considerably less money than in 1920, but was now better equipped than before to do without it, or to get hold of some when necessary.
He had accepted the position of director of the Corbin Bank.
Corbin was quite simply an uncouth individual who had begun his career in a lowly and almost vile manner. It was said he had been a bellboy in an establishment offering loans on the Rue Trudaine. But Corbin was also extremely adept when it came to banking, and in the end he and the Count got along rather well. They were both very intelligent and understood how useful they were to each other. Understanding this created a sort of friendship based on cordial contempt, just like certain liqueurs, which are sharp and bitter on their own, but have a pleasant taste when mixed together.
"He's a degenerate, like all aristocrats," Corbin would mutter.
"The poor man eats with his fingers," Furrier would say with a sigh.
By dangling the prospect of the Jockey Club in front of Corbin's eyes, the Count got whatever he wanted from him. All in all, Furrier had organized his life most comfortably. When the Second Great War of the Century broke out, he felt almost like a child who has worked hard at school, done nothing wrong, and is thoroughly enjoying himself, when someone tells him he must once again be dragged away from his pleasures.
"Once, all right, but twice, that's just too much," he was tempted to cry out. "Pick on someone else, damn it."
How could this be happening? He'd already done his duty. He'd given 5 years of his youth, and now they wanted to steal his precious middle years, those beautiful years when a man finally understands what he is about to lose and is eager to make the most of it.
"No, it's going too far," he remarked despondently to Corbin when he said goodbye to him the day everyone was mobilized. "I'm doomed. I'll never get out alive again."
He was an officer in the reserves. He had to go. He could have fixed it, but his desire for continued self-respect held him back, a very strong inner desire that allowed him a severe, ironic attitude towards the rest of the world. He left. His chauffeur, who was in the same situation as him, said, "If you have to go, you go. But if they think it'll be like 14, they've got it all wrong." The word "they" in his mind meant some mythical council whose purpose and passion was to send other people to their deaths. "If they think we'll do that again," flicking his nail on his tooth, "that, on top of what is strictly necessary, well, I'm telling you, they've got another think coming." The Count de Fourier would certainly not have expressed his own thoughts in this way, but they were nevertheless very similar to his chauffeur's, and simply reflected the state of mind of many former soldiers. A large number of men went off to war this way, feeling muted bitterness or hopeless rebellion against fate, which twice in their lifetimes had played this horrible trick on them. During the June debacle, almost the entire regiment of de Fourier fell into enemy hands. He himself had the chance to escape, and he took it. In 14 he would have preferred to be killed rather than survive the disaster. In 40... he preferred to live. He returned to his wife, who was already mourning his death, to his charming daughters, the eldest of whom had just got married, to a young inspector of public finances, and to the de Ferrière Chateau. The chauffeur wasn't as lucky. He was taken to Stalag 7A and became prisoner number 55,481. Upon his return, the Count got in touch with Corbin, who had remained in the free zone, and they both set about trying to bring the bank's scattered sections back together. The accounting department was in Cahors, the executives in Bayonne, the secretaries had headed for Toulouse, but had got lost somewhere between Nice and Perpignan. No one seemed to know where the bank's papers had ended up.
"It's chaos, a mess, unspeakable mayhem," Corbin said to de Fourier the morning of their first meeting.
He had crossed the demarcation line during the night and welcomed de Fourier into an apartment empty of servants. They had all fled during the exodus, and he suspected them of having taken some brand new suitcases and his morning coat, which aroused within him even more patriotic fury.
"You know me, don't you? I'm not usually emotional, but I nearly cried, my dear man, nearly cried like a baby when I saw the first German at the border. Very correct he was. None of this casual French demeanour, you know, as if to say we're pals. No, really very correct. A brief salute, confident stance, but without being stiff. Very correct. Well, what do you think? Aren't our officers just the worst?"
"Excuse me," said Fourier curtly, "but I don't see how you can reproach our officers.
What do you expect them to do with no weapons and a load of hopeless troops who only want you to piss off and leave them in peace? First, give us some real men.
Oh, but they say there was no one in charge, said Corbin, delighted to offend Furrière.
And just between us, old boy, I saw some pathetic sights. Without the civilians, without everyone panicking, that wave of refugees blocking up the roads, we would have had a chance. Well, you're right there, the panic was terrible. People are extraordinary. For years, we've heard nothing but, it's all-out war, all-out war. You would have thought they'd have expected it. But no. Immediately there's panic, chaos, exodus. And why? I'm asking you, why? It's insane. I only left because the banks were ordered to go. Otherwise, you know.
Was it terrible, Entour?
Absolutely terrible. But again, for the same reason, the flood of refugees. I couldn't find a room outside Tours, so I had to sleep in the city, and naturally we were bombed, forced out by the fires, said Corbin, thinking indignantly of the little chateau in the countryside, where they had turned him away because some Belgian refugees were staying there. They hadn't been hit, not them, while he, Corbin, had nearly been buried under the rubble in Tours. And the chaos, he repeated, everyone thinking only of himself, such egotism. It makes you wonder about mankind. As for your staff, they were the worst of all. Not one of them was able to meet me in Tours. They all lost contact with each other. I had told all our departments to stay together. Do you think they cared? Some are in the Midi, some are up north. You can't count on anyone. These are the circumstances in which you can judge a man, his drive, his energy, his guts. A bunch of drips, I'm telling you, a bunch of drips, only interested in saving their own skin without a thought for the bank or me. Well, some of them are going to get the sack, I can assure you of that. Besides, I don't imagine we're going to have much business.
The conversation turned to more technical matters, which gave them a pleasant feeling of their own importance, barely diminished, despite recent events. A German group, Corbin said, is going to buy out Eastern Steelworks. We're not in too bad a position there, though it's true that the business with the Rouen docks. They became depressed. Furrière said goodbye. Corbin wanted to walk him out, but when he tried to turn on the lights in the drawing room where the shutters were closed, there was no electricity. He started swearing. This man is so vulgar, the Count thought.
Give them a call, he advised. They won't take long to fix it. The telephone's working.
You just can't imagine how chaotic everything is here, Corbin said, choking with rage. The servants have all taken off, all of them, I'm telling you. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if they made off with some of the silver. My wife isn't here. I'm lost in all this mess.
Is Madame Corbin in the free zone?
Yes, Corbin grumbled.
He and his wife had had a painful row. In the chaos of the hurried departure, or perhaps out of malice, the chambermaid had put a small framed picture belonging to Monsieur Corbin in Madame Corbin's bag. It contained a photograph of Arlette, stark naked. The nudity itself might not have offended his wife. She was a person with a great deal of common sense. But the dancer was wearing a magnificent necklace.
But it's not real, I promise you, Monsieur Corbin had said with venom.
His wife refused to believe him. As for Arlette, there was no sign of her. He had heard she was in Bordeaux and was often seen in the company of German officers. Thinking of this only made Monsieur Corbin's mood worse. He pushed his buzzer with all his might.
All I have left is a typist I met in Nice, stupid as they come, but rather pretty. Oh, there you are, he said suddenly to the young brunette who came into the room. The electricity has been cut off. See what you can do about it. Telephone them and give them a good talking to. Well, get on with it, and then bring me the post.
The post hasn't been brought up.
No, it's with the concierge. Chop, chop, go and get it. Do you think I'm paying you to do nothing?
I'm leaving, said Furrière. You frighten me.
Corbin caught a glimpse of the Count's slightly scornful smile. His anger increased.
Poseur, crook, he thought.
Out loud, he replied,
What do you want me to do? They're driving me crazy.
The post contained a letter from the Michaud. They had gone to the bank's head office in Paris, but no one could tell them anything definite. They had written to Nice, and the letter had just been forwarded to Corbin. The Michauds were asking for instructions and some money.
Corbin's vague bad temper finally found something to latch onto.
"Ha! That's a good one," he exclaimed. "They've got some nerve. You run around bending over backwards for people, nearly get killed on the roads of France. Meanwhile, Monsieur and Madame Michaud have a nice holiday in Paris, and then have the cheek to demand money."
"You're going to write to them," he said to the terrified typist. "Take this down. Monsieur Maurice Michaud, 23 Rue Rousselet, Paris, 7th. 25th of July, 1940. Monsieur, on the 11th of June, we gave both you and Madame Michaud the order to take up your duties in the city to which the bank had been evacuated, that is to say, Tours. You will not be unaware that during these crucial moments, every employee of the bank, and you in particular, since you hold a position of trust, is like a soldier. You know what it means to abandon your post in times such as these. The result of your failings was the complete disintegration of the departments entrusted to you, the secretarial and accounting services. This is not the only thing for which we hold you responsible. As we already informed you on the 31st of December last year, when, despite my goodwill towards you, it was not considered possible to award you the increased bonus of 3,000 francs that you requested, it has been pointed out that your department's efficiency is minimal in comparison with that of your predecessors. Under the circumstances, while regretting you have waited such a long time to get in touch with the management, we consider your failure to contact us as a resignation, both by you and Madame Michaud. This resignation, which derives entirely from you and was without any notice, means we are not required to pay you any compensation whatsoever. Nevertheless, taking account of your long employment at the bank as well as the current situation, we are making an exception, and purely as a gesture of goodwill, we are allocating you compensation equivalent to 2 months' salary. Please find enclosed, therefore, a cheque drawn on the Bank of France in Paris, made payable to you in the sum of... Would you please notify us of its safe arrival? Yours sincerely, Corbin.
Corbin's letter plunged the Michauds into despair. They had only 5,000 francs in savings, as Jean-Marie's studies had been expensive. This and their 2 months' salary came to barely 15,000 francs, and they owed money to the taxman. It was almost impossible to find work now. Jobs were rare and badly paid. They had lived a solitary life. They had no relatives, no one to ask for help. They were exhausted by the journey and depressed by their anguish over their son. When Jean-Marie was little and she had faced difficulties, Madame Michaud had often thought, if only he were old enough to manage by himself, nothing would really matter. She had known she was strong and in good health. She felt courageous. She feared nothing for herself, nor for her husband, who thought the same way. Jean-Marie was a man now. Wherever he might be, if he was still alive, he didn't need her. Yet this thought offered little consolation. First of all, she couldn't imagine that her child could do without her, and at the same time, she realized that now she needed him. All her courage abandoned her. She recognized Maurice's frailty. She felt alone, old, ill. How would they find work? What would they live on when their 15,000 francs ran out? She had a few small pieces of jewellery. She cherished them. She'd always said, they're not worth anything. But now she couldn't bring herself to believe that the charming little pearl brooch, the modest ruby ring, gifts from Maurice when they were young, which she loved so much, might not perhaps be sold for a good price. She offered them to the jeweller in her neighbourhood, then to a larger establishment on the Rue de la Paix. But both turned her away. The brooch and the ring were pretty, but they were only interested in the stones, and they were so small it wasn't worth buying them. Madame Michaud was secretly happy at the thought she could keep them, but facts were facts. It had been their only option. By the end of July, their savings were almost gone. They had considered going to see Carpin to explain that they had done their very best to get to Tours, and that if he insisted on letting them go, he at least owed them the normal compensation. But they both had enough experience of him to know they didn't stand a chance. They didn't have the money to take him to court, and Corbin was not easy to intimidate. They also found it wholly repugnant to think of approaching this man whom they loathed and mistrusted. "I just can't do it, Jeanne. Please don't ask me to. I just can't," Maurice said in his soft, low voice. "I think if I found myself standing in front of him, I'd spit in his face, and that wouldn't help matters."
"No," said Jeanne, smiling in spite of herself. "But we're in a terrible situation, my poor darling. It's as if we're heading towards a deep hole, watching it get closer and closer with each step, without being able to escape. It's unbearable."
"But we have to bear it," he replied calmly. He'd used the same tone of voice with her when he'd been wounded in 16 and she'd been called to his bedside at the hospital. "I think my chances of pulling through are about 4 in 10. He had then stopped a moment to think and added conscientiously, 3.5 to be exact. She placed a tender hand on his forehead and thought despairingly, "Oh, if only Jean-Marie were here, he would look after us. He would save us, I know he would. He's young, he's strong." Deep inside, she felt a strange intermingling of her need to protect as a mother and her need to be protected as a woman. "Where is he, my darling boy? Is he still alive? Is he in pain? My God, he can't be dead. It just isn't possible." And her blood ran cold as she realized how very possible it actually was. The tears she had courageously held back for so long welled up in her eyes.
"But why are we always the ones who have to suffer?" she cried out in indignation. "Us and people like us, ordinary people, the lower middle classes. If war is declared, or the franc devalues, if there's unemployment or a revolution or any sort of crisis, the others manage to get through all right. We're always the ones who are trampled. Why? What did we do? We're paying for everybody else's mistakes. Of course they're not afraid of us. The workers fight back, the rich are powerful, we're just sheep to the slaughter. I want to know why. What's happening? I don't understand. You're a man, you should understand," she said angrily to Maurice, no longer knowing whom to blame for the disaster they were facing. "Who's wrong? Who's right? Why Corbin? Why Jean-Marie? Why us?"
"What do you want to understand? There's nothing to understand," he said, forcing himself to stay calm. "Certain laws govern the world, and they're neither for us nor against us. When a storm strikes, you don't blame anyone. You know the thunder is the result of two opposite electrical forces. The clouds don't know who you are. You can't reproach them. And it would be ridiculous if you did. They wouldn't understand."
"But it's not the same thing. What we're going through is down to people and people alone."
"It only seems like that, Jeanne. It all seems caused by this man or that, by one circumstance or another, but it's like in nature. After the calm comes the storm. It starts out slowly, reaches its peak, then it's over, and other periods of calm, some longer, some shorter, come along. It's just been our bad luck to be born in a century full of storms, that's all. They'll die down." "Yes," she said, although she didn't really follow this abstract argument. "But what about Corbin? Corbin's hardly a force of nature, is he?" "He's a harmful specimen, like scorpions, snakes, poison mushrooms. Actually, we're a little bit to blame. We've always known what Corbin was like. Why did we carry on working for him? You wouldn't eat bad mushrooms, and you have to be careful with bad people. There have been several times when we could have found other jobs with a bit of courage and determination. And remember when we were young, I was offered that job as a teacher in Sao Paulo, but you didn't want me to go." "All right, that's ancient history," she said, shrugging her shoulders. "No, I just meant..." "Yes, you just meant we shouldn't hold it against anyone. But you said yourself if you ran into Corbin, you'd spit in his face." They continued arguing, not because they hoped or even wished to win the other over, because talking helped them forget their painful problems.
"Who could we speak to?"
Jeanne finally exclaimed.
You mean you still don't understand that nobody cares about anybody? She looked at him.
You're strange, Maurice. You've seen people at their most cynical, their most disillusioned, and at the same time you're not unhappy. I mean, not really unhappy inside. Am I wrong?
No.
So, what makes it all right, then?
My certainty that deep down I'm a free man, he said, after thinking for a moment. It's a constant, precious possession. And whether I keep it or lose it is up to me and no one else. I desperately want the insanity we're living through to end. I desperately want what has begun to finish. In a word, I desperately want this tragedy to be over and for us to try to survive it, that's all. What's important is to live. Primum vivere, one day at a time, to survive, to wait, to hope. She listened to him without saying a word. Suddenly she got up and grabbed her hat from the mantelpiece. He looked at her in astonishment.
And what I say, she replied, is heaven helps those who help themselves, which is why I'm going to speak to Furrière. He's always been nice to me, and he'll help us even if it's only to annoy Corbin.
Jeanne was right. Furrière spoke to her and promised that she and her husband would each receive compensation, totalling 6 months' salary, which brought their capital up to about 60,000 francs.
You see, I managed and heaven helped me, Jeanne said to her husband when she got home.
And I did the hoping, he replied, smiling.
We were both right.
They were very happy with the outcome. But sensed that now their money worries were off their minds, at least for the immediate future, they would be completely overwhelmed by their anguish over their son.
Chapter 29. It was autumn when Charlie Langelais returned home. The porcelain hadn't been damaged by the journey. He unpacked the large crates himself, trembling with joy when he felt beneath the straw and tissue paper the cool smoothness of a pink glass vase or a Sèvres statuette. He still couldn't believe he was really home, reunited with all his wonderful possessions. He would raise his eyes now and again to look through his windows, which still had their strips of coloured paper, at the delightful curve of the Seine. At noon, the concierge came up to clean. He hadn't yet hired any servants. Important events, whether serious, happy or unfortunate, do not change a man's soul. They merely bring it into relief, just as a strong gust of wind reveals the true shape of a tree when it blows off all its leaves. Such events highlight what is hidden in the shadows. They nudge the spirit towards a place where it can flourish. Charlie had always been careful with money, a penny pincher. When he got back after the exodus, he felt truly miserly. It gave him real pleasure to save money whenever possible, and he was aware of this, for to top it all off, he had become cynical. Before, he would never have considered moving into a disorganized house full of dust. He would have recoiled at the idea of going to a restaurant the very day he returned. Now, however, he had been through so much that nothing frightened him. When the concierge told him that anyway she couldn't finish the cleaning today, that Monsieur didn't realise how much work there was to do, Charlie replied sweetly but firmly,
"You'll manage somehow, Madame Lorgre. You'll just have to work a bit faster, that's all."
"Fast and good don't always go together, Monsieur."
"This time they will. The good old days are over," Charlie said sternly. Then added, "I'll be back at 6 o'clock. I trust that everything will be ready."
And after an imperious glance at the concierge, who was furious but said nothing, and a final loving look at his porcelains, he left. As he went down the stairs, he calculated what he was saving. He wouldn't have to pay for Madame Logre's lunch any more. She could work for him for 2 hours a day for a while. Once the heavy work was done, it wouldn't take much to keep the apartment in order, and he could take his time to find some servants, a couple probably. Until now he had always had a couple, a valet and a cook. He went and had lunch by the river in a little restaurant he knew. He didn't find the food too bad, all things considered. He never ate much anyway, and the wine he drank was excellent.
The owner whispered in his ear that there was still a bit of real coffee left. Charlie lit a cigar and felt that life was good. That is to say, no, not good as such. One mustn't forget the defeat of France and all the suffering, all the humiliation that resulted from it. But for him, Charlie, it was good, because he took life as it came, without moaning about the past or fearing the future. He flicked the ash from his cigar. His money was in America, and since his funds were frozen, fortunately he would have to pay less tax, or perhaps even none at all. The franc would remain low for a long time. His fortune, as soon as he could get hold of it, would automatically be worth 10 times what it was now. As for his day-to-day expenses, he'd made sure to put something aside a long time ago. It was forbidden to buy or sell gold, and it was already fetching outrageous prices on the black market. He thought with amazement of the wave of panic that had swept through him when he had wanted to leave France to go and live in Portugal or South America. Some of his friends had gone, but he was neither Jewish nor a Mason, thank God, he thought with a scornful smile. He had never been involved in politics, and didn't see why he wouldn't be left alone, a poor man like him, very quiet, very harmless, who never hurt anybody, and who loved nothing in this world but his porcelain collection. He thought, on a more serious note, that this was the secret of his happiness amid so much upheaval. He loved nothing, at least nothing that time could distort, that death could carry away. He'd been right not to have married, not to have had children. My God, everyone else had been taken in. He'd been the only clever one. But coming back to that mad idea of emigrating, it had been born of a strange and almost insane belief that in the space of a few days the world was going to change into something horrific, a living hell. But look, everything was the same. He thought of the Bible and the description of the world before the flood. How did it go? Oh, yes, people built houses, got married, ate and drank. Well, the Bible was incomplete. It should have said, the flood waters subsided, and people began once more to build their houses, to marry, to eat and drink. In fact, people weren't really very important. It was works of art, museums, collections that should be saved. What was terrible about the Spanish War was that artistic masterpieces had been left to be destroyed. But here, the most important works had been saved, except for some of the chateaus near the Loire, of course. Now that was unforgivable. But the wine he'd drunk was so good he felt inclined to be optimistic. After all, there were some very beautiful ruins. In Chinon, for example, what could be more admirable than the great hall with no roof, and those walls, walls that had seen Joan of Arc pass, and where now birds nested, and a wild cherry tree grew in a little corner. After lunch, he wanted to stroll through the streets, but he found them depressing. There were hardly any cars. It was extraordinarily silent, and great red flags with swastikas were flying everywhere. In front of a cheese shop, some women were waiting to be served. This was the first war he'd seen. Everyone was gloomy. Charlie hastened towards the metro, the only transport working. He would visit a bar where he was often a regular at lunchtime or in the evening. What havens of peace bars like this were! They were extremely expensive, and their clientele consisted of wealthy men past middle age who hadn't been affected by either the mobilisation or the war. Charlie was alone for a while, but at about 6:30 all the old regulars arrived, safe and sound, and in tip-top form, accompanied by charming and beautifully made-up ladies, who called out from beneath their adorable little hats, "But it's him! It's Charlie, isn't it? Well, now, not too worn out, are you? Come back to Paris? Paris is dreadful, don't you think?" And almost immediately, as if they were meeting again after the most peaceful, the most ordinary of summers, they began the kind of conversation Charlie called fragile, don't-touch conversation. Lively and light-hearted small talk, ranging over any number of subjects, but dwelling on none in particular. Among others, he learned that certain young men had been killed or taken prisoner. "Oh, it can't be!
just imagine. I hadn't the slightest idea. It's awful, oh, those poor boys, he said.
The husband of one of the ladies was a prisoner in Germany. He writes to me regularly. He isn't too bad, but it's the boredom, you see. I hope to be able to get him out soon. The more he talked and the more he heard, Charlie found his spirits rising, and he recovered the good mood that had been momentarily dampened by the sight of the Paris streets. But what succeeded in cheering him up completely was the hat worn by a woman who had just come in. All the women were well-dressed, but with a certain pretense of simplicity, as if to say, we couldn't really dress up, just imagine. First of all, we have no money, and second, it wouldn't be quite right. I'll get some more wear out of my old dresses. But this woman showed off her hat in a daring, courageous, and brazenly happy way. It was a new little hat, hardly bigger than a cocktail napkin, made of two sable skins, with a russet veil over her golden hair. As soon as he saw it, Charlie felt totally reassured. It was getting late. Since Charlie wanted to stop at home before going out to dinner, it was time he went, but he didn't want to leave his friends.
Why don't we all have dinner together? Someone suggested. That's an excellent idea, Charlie said warmly,
and he proposed the little restaurant where he'd had such a good lunch, for he was like a cat by nature, quickly becoming attached to places where he'd been well treated.
I'll have to take the metro again. It's such a ghastly place. It's making my life miserable, he said. I was able to get some petrol and a pass, but I can't offer to drive you back because I promised to wait for Nadine, said the woman in the new hat. How did you do that? It's amazing you could manage that. Ah, well, there it is, she said, smiling. Listen, then, let's meet in about an hour and a quarter. Do you want me to come and collect you? No, thanks. You're very kind. It's only 2 minutes from my place. Be careful. It's pitch black out. They're very strict about that.
She was right. It's really dark, Charlie thought as he emerged from the warm, bright club into the unlit street. It was also raining. Autumn evenings like this were one of the things he used to like so much about Paris. But now you could see fires burning in the distance, and everything was as black and sinister as the inside of a well. Fortunately, the entrance to the metro was nearby. At home, Charlie found Madame Logre sweeping the floor in a preoccupied, gloomy sort of way. At least the drawing room was finished. Charlie had the urge to put his favourite Sèvres statuette on the shiny Chippendale table, a Venus at the looking glass. He took it out of the packing case, removed the tissue paper it was wrapped in, looked at it lovingly, and was taking it over to the table when the doorbell rang.
Go and see who it is, Madame Logre.
Madame Logre went out and then came back, saying, Monsieur, I told the concierge at number 6 that Monsieur needed someone, and she sent this woman who's looking for work. Seeing Charlie hesitate, she added, She's a very nice person who used to be a chambermaid for the Countess Barral du Jeu. She got married and didn't want to work any more, but her husband is a prisoner of war, and she needs to earn a living. Monsieur could just see her and then decide. All right, bring her in, said Langelet, putting the statuette on a table. The woman made a good impression on him. She seemed modest and calm, obviously wishing to please, but without being subservient. He could see at once she'd been well-trained and had worked in fine homes. She was a big woman. Mentally, Charlie reproached her for this. He liked his maids to be thin and a bit austere. But she looked about 35 or 40, the perfect age for a servant, when they've stopped working too quickly but are still fit and strong enough to provide good service. She had a broad face, vast shoulders, and her clothing was simple but appropriate, the dress, coat and hat, definitely hand-me-downs from a former employer.
What's your name? Charlie asked, favourably impressed.
Hortense Gaillard, monsieur.
All right. And you're looking for work?
Well, you see, monsieur, I left the Countess Barral du Jeu 2 years ago to get married. I didn't think I'd have to go back into service, but my husband was conscripted and then taken prisoner, and monsieur will understand that I have to earn a living. My brother is unemployed, and I'm looking after him, his sick wife, and a small child.
I understand. I was thinking of hiring a couple.
I know, monsieur, but maybe I could do instead. I was the head chambermaid for the Countess, but before that I worked for the Countess's mother as a cook. I could do the cooking and the cleaning.
Yes, that's possible, Charlie murmured, thinking that such a combination would be very advantageous financially.
Naturally, there was also the matter of serving meals. He did sometimes have dinner guests, but then he wasn't expecting too many this winter.
Do you know how to iron men's clothing? I'm very particular about that, you understand.
I was the one who ironed the Count's shirts.
What about your cooking? I often eat out. I require simple but carefully prepared food.
Would Monsieur like to see my references? She reached into an imitation pigskin handbag and handed them to him. He read them one after the other. They spoke of her in the warmest terms, hard-working, extremely well-trained, scrupulously honest, very good at cooking, and even making pastries.
Even pastries? Very good. I think, Hortense, that we can come to an arrangement. Were you with the Countess Barral du Jeu for long?
5 years, monsieur.
And is the good lady in Paris? I prefer personal recommendations, you understand.
I understand completely, monsieur. Yes, the Countess is in Paris. Would monsieur like her phone number? It's Auteuil 3814.
Thank you. Write it down, would you, Madame Logre?
And what about wages? How much were you hoping to earn?
Hortense asked for 600 francs. He offered 450. Hortense thought for a moment. Her shrewd little dark eyes had seen into the soul of this arrogant, well-fed man. And work was scarce.
I couldn't do it for less than 550, she said firmly. Monsieur must understand, I had some savings, but they were all used up during that horrible journey.
You left Paris?
During the exodus, yes, monsieur. Bombed and everything, quite apart from nearly starving to death on the road. Monsieur doesn't know how bad it was.
But I do know, I do, Charlie said, sighing.
I, too, was on the road. Such sad events.
We'll say 550, then. But listen now, I'm agreeing because I think you will earn it. I insist on absolute honesty.
Oh, monsieur, said Hortense in a discreetly scandalized tone of voice, as if the thought alone would have wounded her to the core. And Charlie was quick to smile at her reassuringly, to make her see he was only saying it as a formality, that he didn't doubt her absolute integrity for a moment, and that, moreover, the very idea of such dishonesty was so unbearable to him that he wouldn't give it another thought.
I hope you are good at what you do. And careful, I have a collection that is very important to me. I don't allow anyone to dust the most precious pieces, but this display cabinet over here, for example, I would trust you with.
As he seemed to be inviting her to have a look, Hortense glanced at the half-unpacked cases.
Monsieur has some very beautiful things. Before going into service for the Countess's mother, I worked for an American, Mr. Mortimer Shaw. He collected ivory pieces.
Mortimer Shaw? What a coincidence. I know him well. He's an eminent antiques dealer.
He's retired, monsieur.
And were you with him long?
4 years. They were the only two jobs I had.
Charlie stood up and saw Hortense to the door, saying encouragingly,
Come back tomorrow for a definite decision, will you? If the verbal references are as good as your written ones, which I don't doubt for a moment, then you are hired. Could you start right away?
On Monday, if monsieur would like.
After Hortense had gone, Charlie hurried to change his collar and cuffs and wash his hands. He'd had a lot to drink at the bar. He felt extraordinarily light-headed and pleased with himself. He didn't wait for the lift, an ancient, slow piece of equipment, but sped down the stairs like a young man. He was going to meet his lovely friends, a charming woman. He was delighted to be able to introduce them to the little restaurant he'd discovered.
I wonder if they've got any of that Coton wine left, he thought.
The great courtyard door with its wooden panels engraved with sirens and tritons, a marvel, classified a work of art by the Council for Historic Monuments of Paris, opened and closed behind him with a faint creak. Once outside, Charlie was immediately plunged into the impenetrable darkness. But, feeling as happy and free as a 20-year-old, he crossed the road without a care and headed for the quayside. He had forgotten his torch.
"But I know every step of the way in my neighbourhood," he said to himself. "All I have to do is follow the Seine and cross the Pont-Marie. There won't be many cars."
And at the very moment he was mentally saying these words, a car passed 2 feet in front of him, going extremely fast, its headlights painted blue in accordance with regulations, giving off only the faintest light. Startled, he jumped backwards, slipped, felt himself lose his balance, flailed his arms about, and finding nothing to grab onto, fell into the road. The car swerved, and a woman's voice screamed in terror, "Watch out!" It was too late.
"I've had it. I'm going to be run over. To have made it through so much danger to end up like this, it's too ridiculous. Someone's playing a trick on me. Someone, somewhere, is playing this horrible, bad trick on me."
Just as a bird, terrified by a gunshot, flies out of its nest and disappears, so this final conscious thought went through Charlie's mind and vanished at the same moment as his life. He took a terrible blow to the head. The car's fender had shattered his skull. Blood and brains spurted out with such force that a few drops landed on the woman who was driving, a pretty woman wearing a hat hardly bigger than a cocktail napkin, made of 2 sable skins sewn together and a russet veil over her golden hair. It was Arlette Corail, back from Bordeaux the week before. She looked down at the body.
"What rotten luck," she mumbled, devastated. "But really... what rotten luck."
She was a cautious woman and had her torch with her. She examined the man's face, at least what was left of it, and recognised Charles Langelet.
"Oh, the poor guy. I was going fast all right, but he couldn't have been paying attention, the silly fool. What am I going to do now?"
Nevertheless, she remembered that her insurance, license, pass were all in order, and she knew someone influential who would fix everything for her. Somewhat reassured, but her heart still pounding, she sat down for a moment on the car's running board, lit a cigarette, fixed her makeup with trembling hands, then went to get help. Madame Logre had finally finished cleaning the study and library. She went into the drawing room to get the vacuum cleaner. As she pulled out the plug, the handle of the vacuum cleaner knocked against the table where the Venus at the looking glass was displayed. Madame Logre screamed. The statuette had fallen onto the floor. The head of Venus was smashed to bits. Madame Logre wiped her forehead with her apron, hesitated a moment, then, leaving the statuette where it was, put the vacuum cleaner away. After that, in a manner that was surprising for such a stout woman, she rushed silently and nimbly out of the apartment.
"Right. I'll just say, the door flew open and a gust of wind knocked the statue over. It's his fault, too. Why leave it at the edge of the table? And anyway," she said angrily, "I don't care what he says. It can go to hell for all I care."
Chapter 30. If anyone had told Jean-Marie that he would one day find himself in a remote village, far from his regiment,